Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the December 13th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist and author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. We are together again, and this is sometimes where we make our best magic. I just got back from JFK. I walked through my door at Newport Beach at 2 o'clock in the morning coming back from LAX, and then I had to start, you know, market stuff, and the CPI number was coming
did
at
you
5
go to,
a.m.
Did you go to sleep in that case?
I did. I slept for exactly 3 hours.
Wow.
On the dot. And sometimes I might have even slept a little bit on the plane coming back over on those where it's not a red eye, but it's kind of late. And just because of the time change on my body, it's like you get to a point where I'm almost up for 24 hours
right.
And you just are tired.
Yeah.
But I generally don't sleep on planes unless it's a real red eye, meaning going from west to east.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't sleep last night. I had too much work to do. And then now I'm just plugging away. And while we're recording, I'm going to have the office manager here at TBG in Newport bring me in a coffee.
Oh, good.
Because I've only had two cups today. I would do that on a normal day. I would do that when I've gotten a full 5.5
right.
hours of sleep. But I'm working off of half sleep.
I wish I'd known. I'd have brought you a mocha. Hey, this is the week in 1818 when California's only known pirate, a guy named Hippolyte de Bouchard, a French-born pirate who, and I'll explain pirate in just a sec, because it's actually a term of art, but he raided the California coast, which at the time in 1818 was under the flagging Spanish imperial rule still, and he went bombing down from Monterey to Santa Barbara and landed at Dana Point, right near us, David,
yeah.
And raided the San Juan Mission. He was.
I wonder if he had to deal with traffic at the 5 and 405 at the Y there up at El Toro.
Legendarily bad. Yeah. He complained about it. Long story short, it's
because, that is before the toll road. There was no 73.
Yeah. That's so much worse. But this guy's really amazing. And I want to footnote pirate because he was under a letter of marque. They were called MARQUE. And at the time, that meant Sir Francis Drake, famously a quote unquote pirate, but really not a pirate because he was working as an informal. An agent of the Queen, Sir Francis Drake was, and Hippolyte de Bouchard was working for the Argentinians.
God, you are so pretentious.
Am I really?
Well, say that again. I mean, come on. What do you think?
Let's talk about the Heisman.
Oh, yeah. You know what? Didn't you sort of think we were going to be stuck not being able to talk about SC football after we had our whole thing last
yeah.
week? And we got some great feedback on
mm-hmm,
that,
mm-hmm.
by the way. But what a wonderful speech. I got to watch it.
Well, let's back up. This is USC quarterback Caleb Williams. He's one of four four finalists. He is the favorite throughout, I think. But there was
he became the favorite definitely in the last month of the year.
Yes.
I wouldn't say he was on the favorites list through the first half of the season.
No, I'm sorry.
And he just week by week kept playing his way up and others would have some bad games and so forth, but he by the time we got there, and they did it at a spot off Columbus Circle. My apartment for years in the city was two buildings over.
Oh, wow.
It was right there. I'm now on the east side, but I was in New York, and it was funny. I had a bunch of meetings Saturday, and I'm eating dinner, and I'm like, I'm going home to watch this. I'm not going to miss this. And I just packed up the rest of what I had on my plate and put it in a to-go and got home, and I got to watch it live in New York.
Well, for those who hate football and particularly don't care about USC football,
then don't stop listening?
Yeah, I suppose, or just hit the fast-forward button a couple of times. But I really do want to ask, because I missed the speech. I've heard great things about it. If you could sum it up in 30 seconds or fewer, why was it great? What made Caleb Williams' speech so great?
I don't know that the speech was necessarily the most articulate thing of all time. It was very heartfelt. He covered a lot of bases. This is a byproduct of the NIL era. He had flown out all of his offensive linemen.
Yes.
And no one's ever done that. But of course, no one necessarily impoverishing mm-hmm. Phariseeism of mm-hmm. the amateur moment mm-hmm. weren't allowed to do it, weren't capable of doing it. But I would add, I'm not sure very many people have the heart to do it, even now that a lot of these quarterbacks do have a couple bucks in their quarterback they can do something like that with. Caleb has a couple bucks as a result of NIL, and he was willing to do it. But doing it was more than just the financials. It was the acknowledgement publicly of I'm up here and you guys are a big part of the reason, the your protection and whatnot. Now, ironically, Caleb won the Heisman Trophy winner because of what he's able to do when his pass protection breaks down. He is a scramble out of the pocket miracle worker quarterback, both with his feet and his arm when he gets out of the pocket. But either way, his offensive linemen were fantastic. We had, you know, two starters who were gone against Utah, which is a huge one before the game and one during the game, which is a big part of why, you know, we had our struggles there. But for him to acknowledge them, and then the way he spoke about his mother and father was very endearing, and just this notion of his goal setting, how he would write down what he wanted
to
do.
He journaled.
He had his high school coach there. He acknowledged him. He journaled the different things he had set about as goals in his life. And then actually, I loved this line so much that I sent it to my kids. Change your dreams or change your habits, I was told. Well, I'm damn sure not going to change my dreams.
Wow.
And I think that's right, because we do have this sort of implicit belief in society that somehow dreams come true just because they...
Because you want them.
They roll down the hill. And his point is that the habits were what were necessary to bring them about. And he's a tireless worker. He's a great young man, impressive guy. And USC now, of course, is the leader. Most Heisman Trophy wins at eight. And then, you know, modern day is at three and UCLA is at one. Just a little high school with three Heisman trophies, no big deal. Fascinating, only one other school even has two Heismans.
Is that right?
Only one other high school even has two. But yeah, even like the great Alabama only has four Heisman Trophy winners, which I was surprised. I thought they had five or six. But anyway, so fight on, Caleb, and they have unfinished business. We'll be out at the Cotton Bowl. We should do a Radio Free California sometime from a USC game.
I would love to do that. That would be an absolute blast.
It'd be fun for us, and it would just sort of be the ultimate trolling of all those people who send us those just absurd emails.
I am so sympathetic because I'm married to a woman who walks into the room, and if the SC game is on, she does a 180 very, very quickly. She has the same reaction to USC football, hey, Erica, that I have to anything to do with reality TV.
You know what's ironic is that U.S. Football is
reality television.
And,
I agree.
And reality TV is not reality.
It's not. Okay, so let's start with a few hors d'oeuvres, if we may. One of my favorite stories this week, my daughter sent it to me, and then a couple of listeners sent it as well. And I think this just caught everybody's fancy. Now, this was supposed to be sweet, so here it is, sweet first, and let's talk about the darker implications. Officials approve, this is the headline, officials approve girls' request to keep unicorn in backyard. The L.A. County Animal Care and Control this week shared a letter it received from a child named Madeline, or Madeline. The girl wrote, Dear L.A. County, I would like your approval if I can have a unicorn in my backyard. If I can find one, please send me a letter in response. Director Marcia Mayeda replied with a letter along with a pre-approved unicorn license, a heart-shaped license tag, and a plush toy unicorn until Madeline finds a real one. Photos of the license and Madeline's letter were posted to the agency's social media account. The licensing letter included five conditions. This is where all of our listeners now have their spidey senses a-tingle. The unicorn must be cared for in compliance with all animal caretaking regulations set forth in L.A. County Code Title 10. The unicorn is given regular access to sunlight, moonbeams, and rainbows. The unicorn is fed one of its favorite treats, watermelon, at least once each week. I did not know that about unicorns. The unicorn's horn must be maintained in good health. This requires polishing at least once a month with a soft cloth. Any sparkles or glitter used on the unicorn must be non-toxic and biodegradable to ensure the unicorn's good health. The director commended Madeline for her sense of responsible pet ownership. Yes, sweet. Kind of like, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa. Yes, Madeline, there is a unicorn, and you now have a license for one. It's the idea that an L.A. County kid is so adept at already understanding the regulatory environment that she would ask for a permit to keep an imaginary animal, and that the county would almost in self-parody agree that a license was required. I hate to be the... But my daughter sent it to me and said, oh, this cute. But it sure strikes me as kind of darkly comic. There we
good
go.
Good stuff. I like it.
All right. You and I were...
I haven't looked at your playlist. I don't even know what order you're going in. I just know some of the stories that are coming. I have it up.
Oh, okay, good.
And it's going to be fun because, God, we got some good material this week.
It was a week. It was a week.
It was a week.
Here's a headline. New video shows...
Oh, moments. Are we going to talk about Caleb winning the Heisman?
Let's do that. I haven't even mentioned it. Were you in New York when it happened? Here's the headline. New video shows moments before fight between L.A. Councilman Kevin DeLeon and activist. The background for our listeners is, y'all know, the tape. We've discussed this a number of times now, but the leaked tape from a meeting of LA City Council members in which they engaged in disparaging and racist remarks, all of them Latino, all of them meeting at the LA Federation of Labor building. So in other words, unions control the meeting. They have this offsite meeting at a labor headquarters, the group that is the umbrella organization for all public.
I didn't realize that's where they were.
Yeah. Yeah, they were.
By the way, the word, and I can't really explain this. I can't defend it. I'm just going off of one of these kind of freewheeling gut things. The word federation just is not good as it pertains to like this stuff. We talk about government and unions and just some sort of organized body. If you see the word federation, it's not going to usually be the World Wrestling Federation.
No, they are coming for your unicorn.
Like the WWF might be the most reputable federation on the planet.
Compared to this, yes. So these guys all meet there. You all know the story. The tape is released. The secret recording is released. And virtually everybody but Kevin DeLeon decides they're out, right? Kevin DeLeon says, nope, I'm not leaving.
Oh, no, the other person
I'm sorry, Gil Cedillo is still on.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't think Gil is showing up at the LA City Council meetings. Kevin DeLeon has, but occasionally. But
that's
when
so fresh. I said racist stuff. I won't step down, but I will not come to meetings anymore.
That's right. Who doesn't want the paycheck for not working, apparently?
But maybe what Gil could say is, look, I don't want to go to those meetings because what if I go and I say something more racist? So it's just better for everybody. You guys don't want to hear me say racist stuff.
Well, here's the update. Kevin DeLeon, and I'll pause for your reaction to this in a moment. Kevin DeLeon shows up at a Christmas holiday kind of gift giving thing in East LA, in his district in Lincoln Heights, and they are handing out Christmas gifts to all little kids. There's a DJ, mixing up Christmas hits and that sort of thing. And DeLeon is wearing a jaunty little Santa cap. But he is being trolled the entire time, mobbed, in fact, by people chanting that he needs to resign. He's just trying to hand out gifts. Now, whatever else you think of DeLeon, he's just trying to hand out Christmas gifts to poor kids, right? And these people show up, these activists, and they start heckling him. And when he tries to leave, they block him.
And I think you should – I didn't know this at the time I sent you the clip. The guy you're about to talk about, apparently he's been showing up at his events.
Yeah.
Like kind of like what we used to call – when it's a female involved, a stalker.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. His name is Jason Reedy. He's with a group here called, I'm totally blanking on it. It's Roots LA, I think, is the name of the group. Is that right, David? Do you remember that?
Yeah, Roots LA.
Yeah. An activist organization. And the video that is first released just shows Santa Claus / DeLeon driving this guy's head into a wall before he pantses him and throws him out the door. I say pants. He grabs him by the belt loop, it looks like, and just hauls him out the door. It's a pretty assertive act, but you don't know what preceded it until much later. And then you had sent me later that night, oh, here's the full take. And the full take is this guy's in front of him. This guy Reedy's in front of DeLeon, and he's holding up his camera to videotape the whole interaction. And he literally corners DeLeon. He backs him up against a wall and then headbutts him. Now, some media accounts say lightly, but if you are aggressively pushing me toward a wall and your head hits mine not once but twice,
By the way, I've been thinking about this a lot because I was so pleased, as is almost always the case in the years and years now you and I have been doing this, we've developed instinct and share of certain value system and for the most part a prudential judgment on things. We're often aligned without knowing where the other person is. And that was the case here. But as I was reading the other people saying, I don't care, this Kevin DeLeon, he was the instigator, he was wrong. This guy, he has a right to protest. He has a right to share his political opinion. First of all, even apart from if you consider it a headbutt or not, I just want to suggest a governing principle. Pretend anytime we're discussing these things that the person is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. do you believe that another person could come into someone's vertical space like that if it were a woman? And force themselves into the room. That's the thing, is De Leon left the situation.
That's right. He tried
to
leave.
He did allow the guy to troll him.
Yeah.
He did allow the guy to scream at him, threaten him, phone in the face.
Yeah.
All the way as he walked into a private space. He got in a private space, closed the door, and the guy came in.
Right.
So by any reasonable person's definition, this is an act of aggression.
That's right.
And then the physical intrusion into space and then putting his head up right there. I don't think he drew blood on him, but he did initiate contact. And yes, then De Leon came back. But this was, all I was thinking as I was watching this is, I can't believe that, and there's, now De Leon has two enemies, Will. That's the problem. The left is lying about what happened because
right.
they want him to go because mm-hmm. he's an embarrassment for what he said racially, and he should go.
Mm-hmm.
But then the conservatives want this because it's a Democrat.
Democrat on Democrat violence.
Left-leaning candidate. And I saw on the Twitter feed, I'm not going to say which one, but one of the conservative networks asking if they could use the footage.
Yes.
Because it plays right into this narrative.
That's right.
And look, we caught a moment on tape of gotcha of a Democrat losing it. And I won't have it. You and I have talked more trash on Kevin DeLeon than
yes.
anybody. I can't stand the guy. He was not in the wrong here. I'm not going to say he was just
right.
because. And this whole Me Too moment, we know that if that was a woman, we would not be saying the same things. You cannot, if some guy gets up in my space like that, that guy is going to get something far worse
yeah.
as long as I have a lot of my tough friends around than what, what Kevin did to him. That was totally unacceptable. And it's a ridiculous conversation.
Yeah.
People are like, well, look, I mean, he's the city councilman. You got to let people get in your face and follow you into
yeah.
a private room
yeah.
and headbutt you. That's what you signed up for. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Now, Kevin should resign, though.
Yeah.
Should.
It's true. It's true. All right. I do love that the media is now reporting this like there's, you know, we've seen the video, the two sides, and this guy's alleging, and that you who are you going to believe, you know?
Yeah, both sides are yeah. alleging.
Yes.
I thought that was the point of video technology. No one's alleging. They're
no,
hitting play.
That's right.
I'm really curious. Yeah. What are you okay? Because I'm not going to read the emails. Only you are, as is always the case. Are you okay if we ask readers that watch it to share what they think?
I think we should. The video is in
I'm
the
not
story.
Readers, listeners. I mean, am I wrong that this is open and shut?
Oh, I don't have any doubt about it at all. No, zero. I am with you. And that was the fun thing, as per usual, when we are texting back and forth. That
now, maybe yeah. one of the arguments is it was the other guy. He instigated, but Kevin has it coming because he was in the room for those racist things.
No.
And he said,
no.
Now,
it was separate events.
Is Kevin going to city council meetings?
Yes.
Is he participating?
Yes.
Is he still taking a lot of breaks? Because remember, that was his defense. He was on a break for all the racist comments. Those
yeah.
were his words.
Those were his words indeed. Yeah, I wasn't really in the room when a lot of that stuff was being said.
I also don't like city council people giving gifts to poor people.
Even if it's their own gift?
Their own poor people?
No, their own gift.
No, I think it's pharisaical.
Really? Tell me
yeah.
about that.
No, just knock it off. Like,
no, I want to hear this. I think I agree with you. I'm intrigued. I hadn't even thought of this, but I'm starting to like it already. Go.
Yeah, I think it is done for show.
Yes.
It's performative.
I am the gift giver. I am your government official, and I am the gift giver.
Yeah.
I have a Santa hat on.
At home, sit down with your wife, figure out who you want to support, what you want to give, volunteer with no cameras, show up and serve some food.
There is a biblical injunction here, is there
not? Black and white, word for word?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's repeated over and over. You could argue it's the most commonly uttered edict from Jesus, the man, to the Pharisees.
Yes.
Was to quit doing their things as acts of show.
That's right. And doesn't he talk about the widow's mite?
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we won't even dig into that much farther. I think no more needs be said. Here's one of my favorite stories of the week. It is a story that most people will have missed, but I want to just give a little bit of background on this. Here's the headline from the Sacramento Bee. Ousted California Union President demands removal of 42 SEIU board members in new lawsuits. So here's the background. SEIU is the Service Employees International Union. They have been hemorrhaging members. Full disclosure, they have been hemorrhaging members because California Policy Center is inviting those members to leave their union. They are now up to about 34% of union reduction. This is a huge impact on their revenue. So they have turmoil inside. Now, this guy who is filing a lawsuit is Richard Brown. He was elected as a reform candidate saying, look, our union is losing members. Let's get out of politics. Let's cut membership dues and get back to the business of serving our members. That upended his union. The old guard went ballistic. They literally had the locks changed on his office. And when he finally got in and he took some of the documents out of the office, they alleged that he had stolen these documents, even though he was the SEIU president at the time. He's now like permanently shut out. There's a state judge, huge surprise, who has sided with the deep state of this SEIU union. And one can't help feeling sympathy for Richard Brown, who is now suing and saying that these people had him illegally removed, that they violated the popular vote, which he won 2021, I want to say it was, late 2021. Long story short, SEIU is in turmoil. And conservatives ought to be glad that this union is having to rethink itself. But the predictable outcome is that the establishment guys who see the SEIU as an ATM for the Democratic Party, they're not going to let this happen. They're going to stay involved. They're going to fight harder. They are behind many of the worst laws in California and many of the worst propositions that you saw in the most recent ballot. Everybody remembers the perennial loser, the SEIU-backed kidney dialysis propositions that show up every 2 years now, which are just make work jobs for the union. This is a bad union. The workers may be wonderful, and in fact, they likely are. They are our neighbors. They do good work. They do a lot of the state business that is necessary to a well-functioned and well-ordered society. But as a union, this is a toxic group, and watching this thing just melt down has been one of the high points for me of 2022.
Love it.
I just wanted to put this one on the show notes, David, and I ought to have told you why I've got it in here. There's a new assembly member from West LA, Santa Monica, to be particular, specific. His name is Rick Chavez, and I think his last name is pronounced Zibur. It's Z-B-U-R. There should be a vowel between Z and B, but there's not. Zibur. His first day, he gets into office, and he files two bills.
One Santa Monica City Council.
There you know the guy.
No, I was repeating what you just said.
He's from Santa Monica. He was not on the council.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he is from Santa Monica. And he is the former head of, he is the executive director of Equality California, the nation's largest statewide LGBTQ+ civil rights organization. But the diverse communities, which LGBTQ.
How do you become the largest? Is it with the most initials or the most, like if you, is it from fundraising staff? Or is it the most LG? We are the largest. We have LGBTQZ and...
I think it's because their dreams are so big.
Oh.
Yeah. Just to go back to Caleb.
All right. So they're the largest.
So they're the largest, probably by money and influence in the state legislature. So anyway, this guy now just skips the middleman. That is, instead of trying to lobby the state legislature, he becomes a state legislator. And he has two bills immediately on swearing in. This is from his own press release. Assemblymember Rick Chavez Zibur introduces first two bills on swearing in day. So the guy has barely been sworn in. He has had to sit through the governor's commission on how to gouge the oil industry, punish them for high gasoline prices. We've already been through all that. I won't relitigate. But his new Assembly Bill 5, this is not the same old bad Assembly Bill 5. This is a new bad Assembly Bill 5. Here it is. It's called the Safe and Supportive Schools Act. It will help equip teachers and school staff with tools and training they need to support LGBTQ+ students and make California schools safer and more supportive for all students, teachers, and school staff. The bill will specify a timeline for implementation by all California schools of the cultural competency training for teachers and certificated staff currently under development by the Department of Education. Okay, so we have one of the poorest school systems in the entire nation. Poorest in terms of performance, richest in terms of expenses. I won't go into all the financing, but we spend more per K-12 student than any other school system in the nation, and we have among the very, very worst results. I won't go into this again because we've covered it. And this guy, as teachers complain, the problem's not with them. The teachers unions always say, hey, it's not us. And then they point to a variety of other things. Primarily, it's been white supremacy lately. It used to be we don't get enough money, but that argument's now been made bogus. They still use it. We need to tax the rich more.
But they're fired up against white supremacy.
They do not like white supremacy. And yet...
they probably are against white supremacy and Nazism.
They might even be against Nazis.
Yeah.
But the fact is that they run what I would regard as probably the most racist, and I mean this in the literal sense. This is a systemic racist system, public education in California. And it is so because of the intervention of the teachers union, which prohibits any kind of choice and which locks in poor kids into lousy performing schools and rewards the best teachers at precisely the same level as the worst teachers. It's a factory system in which there is no other metric but the years you have paid into your union. That's how your quality is measured, not by your test results of your kids, not by getting them to perform better on state tests or federal tests, none of that. It's just you've paid us the most money. That's their measure. And it locks in poor performing schools. It locks poor students into those schools. I could go on, you know, the drill. Yeah. But these teachers complain that they are overworked. They're exhausted. They're wrung out by all the challenges they face. And yet they back a clown like this. And yes, Rick Chavez-Zibor, you are a clown.
Yeah.
If you sincerely believe that adding this quote-unquote cultural competency is going to make teachers' lives better. Look, here's the bottom line. If you treat your students poorly for any reason, if you treat them poorly, you dehumanize them, you are a bad person. I don't care what your excuse is, whether it's race, ethnicity, class, whatever, religiosity, non-religious, doesn't matter. You're a bad person. You belong in another profession. You belong maybe, I don't know, in some sort of racially driven kind of white supremacy or black supremacy or whatever it is group. This new AB 5 bill will exhaust teachers. They will have to spend more time now getting cultural competency classes, testing for that so they can maintain their credential. And it will take more hours out of their lives and put them on the hot seat again for anybody anywhere who claims I was made to feel bad in my classroom. Never mind math, never mind reading. These are the things that we no longer care about because they too are white supremacists. Never mind qualifying for your exams to get into a great school because we've eliminated those now in the Cal State and UC systems. What's really important is that teachers be drilled on their attentiveness to the needs of supposed specifically LGBTQ, etc. All right.
I am pretty sure we're on the same page on this. I think that there was a point for a long time where the tactic in decrying union activities was to draw a distinction politically between the recipients of the unions, the objects of the union's efforts, the workers, and then the union itself. So in other words, it was sort of like, hey, we're not after the teachers here, but these teachers' unions are doing some bad things.
Yes.
And I think that that was probably the appropriate tactic for politically, and it may still be to some degree. But I also think, even apart from the tactics and politics of it, it was probably mostly accurate. But I don't believe it anymore.
Tell me. I'm where you are.
I think during the COVID, look, I think firemen, prison guards, police, I think it's different. I think there are some bad apples and some good apples, and that's always been the case. But as a movement, like a majority, like when we're talking about something over 70% of critical mass, I don't believe that most cops are abusive, and I don't think most cops are saying, how can we game the system to spike pensions and get out of here? I know some people do bad things, but I think those are the minority, and I think the unions are wrong to go protect bad actors who are the minority. But with the teachers, I think during the COVID moment, I don't know what the split is. I have no interest in polling it, but I don't think it's 99-1. 99 good, 1 bad, and the union's spoiling it for the rest of them. I think there's a whole lot at this point that are now morally viable, responsible
viable. Mm-hmm.
For what is being done on their behalf. At some point, you can't just say, look, that's what they do. We're just here to teach. They were pushing hard to not have to teach out of the COVID moment. And some of these things, these examples that come up that you find all over the place, they don't just look bad on the unions. They look bad on the people who are pushing the unions to do it.
That's right. Well, I disagree with you only in this modest regard. I think that all unions and government unions in California are corrupt. That is, by definition, they are corrupt.
I agree with that.
They are organized to collect dues so they can influence the election of people who will then turn around and give them the deals they want. It's legal, but it's corrupt.
I don't disagree.
And the prison guards, the cops, the firefighters are among the very worst, along with the teachers.
Okay, but that isn't what I said, though. And by
no,
the way,
I understand.
The prison guards, I might actually agree. I know some pretty... I wouldn't want that job, obviously.
No, but, it's
I
mean, terrible job.
But let's just stick with the police for a second. What I'm saying is when you talk to police and they have certain pensions, I've never heard a cop ever say, I want to game the system, or I hope that I can abuse someone and then a union rep will come get mm-hmm. me out of it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the majority.
No, that's not how they think. But I do think that they must be able to look around and see what their union does and acknowledge that it's injury to the public
profession. But you may be giving them more credit. It may be ignorance is bliss.
It might be, but I don't know how it can be. I'm thinking of specific examples where police unions have been taken over by really bad cops. Cops who themselves are corrupt individuals and are knowingly elected by their peers because they are the most aggressive in asserting an absolute blanket indemnification for all cops, no matter what. And that's one small part of it. The bigger part of it for me remains their impact on politics and their obstructionism where reform is concerned, their willingness to ally. Like who showed up at the LA teacher strike in 2019, the biggest strike in the nation at that point? Cops, firefighters, prison guards, all government unions showed up in alliance with the teachers who were trying to shut down schools for 5 days, and then who did nothing to stop the teachers' shutdown of public schools, didn't criticize them, didn't say anything about it. So I say, love the cops, love the firefighters, love individuals who are teachers and all that stuff. But if you belong to a union that does these things, you are responsible. So speaking about this guy, Chavez Zabur out of Santa Monica, Karen Bass was inaugurated. This is a trifecta of fun stuff for us because she was Karen Bass ran against Rick Caruso. She wins in a really tight race. It took weeks, I think, to finalize that thing. I want to say 2 weeks. Who reads the inauguration, who gives her the oath? I can't remember what the phrase is here. Our buddy Kamala Harris flies out from D.C. To her home in West L.A., spends a night there, and then inaugurates Karen Bass. What's Karen Bass's first act as mayor? Dreams, baby, dreams. Just like Caleb was talking about.
Yeah.
Her first act is... let me see, swore her in, celebrated the historic win. Ms. Bass said that her first act, I'm reading from the New York Times. Ms. Bass said her first act as mayor on Monday would be to declare a state of emergency on homelessness.
Oh.
Wow. That's going to change everything. Are there any details to this? No, there are not. We also, one of my favorite things about this inauguration, by the way, is not just the symbolism.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Please.
I don't want to do it. I was fine with a certain degree of actionable relevance with it, and I was even okay with some kind of posturing or symbolic significance, but I now believe this whole concept of state of emergency, the very words in any sort of political setting need to be eliminated forever.
Like the word federation.
Well, federation is I don't have specifics. There's something real creepy about that word.
It just makes
you
feel bad.
It's not good. And I know what a federation, I mean, it's a mafia family, but it's legal, and there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, this reminds me of the habit of federal officials to name czars, right? The czar of this or that, drug policy or crime
or
whatever.
But it used to be that it was your opponents saying, oh, you've appointed this domestic czar,
right.
And it was meant as a pejorative.
That's
now
right.
We do it as like, yeah, I've now appointed a czar of a certain thing, and you're like, that's not
a good word.
Think that word. And, you know, by the way, the first person in my adult life that I recall doing it was George H.W. Bush was really struggling in the polls in his campaign for reelection. And he was running against Bill Clinton in 92. And he had really high ratings on foreign policy and really terrible ratings on domestic affairs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he thought he'd get in front of it by saying, I'm appointing James Baker as my domestic czar of all domestic policy. And I remember thinking, first of all, there's nothing I love more than for James Baker to be running mm-hmm. for president and not you.
Yeah.
But second of all, I don't think that the public is waiting for you to appoint a czar.
Yeah.
And then now it's become very normal language.
Yeah.
But state of emergency, if it means something that you and I talked about a lot, where the government now can suspend the Constitution because of emergency moment, that already has gotten a point of abuse. But we do have, we can go to the courts and just say, like, hey, I don't think COVID in its 15th year of people still sneezing on each other necessarily warrants the state having the right to do other things that they're doing. And states like California and New York kept holding on to emergency powers because they knew it gave them some actionable leeway for doing more abusive things than they could do without it. But this thing about I'm declaring a state of emergency because a hurricane came through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you could just do is say, I declare that a hurricane came through.
Yeah.
You dumbass. I declare that all of the buildings are falling. That, like, I don't need you to tell me if it's an emergency.
I can see it.
Like, all those people are homeless and dying and on drugs and mentally ill and unsafe. And I think that's I declare it bad. I'm just being serious here. Stop with this stuff.
Well, I do want to see what she's going to do that's different. Again, there's no details on this, or at least none that I could find. I mean, it goes back to the Caleb Williams line that, you know, if you don't have goals to achieve your dreams, then all you got is really a dream. And that's, you got to change one of those things, the dream or the goals. I'm sorry, it wasn't goals. What was it?
Habits.
Habits, thank you.
But maybe, but like, it seems to me in this case, though, we're not just talking about you don't have a plan, that then San Francisco had a plan. It's mm-hmm. We're going to give pipes to people to
that's
do
right.
drugs on
yes.
the street.
Yes.
That was the plan.
Yeah.
So I think that they have codified homelessness, not sought to cause to cure homelessness. And you don't get to call something a state of emergency that you're wanting to embed. You want to structurally embed it. I don't think you get to call it a state of emergency. But even if you have a plan, you don't need to call it a state of emergency.
No, I have a plan.
Just go do something.
Yeah.
It's like if you have an argument with your wife and you're like, we need to kind of work on this disagreement. You go, well, before we do, I'd like to declare that we're in an argument.
Well, I want to make offer a wonderful three cheers for an Instagram account that is linked to Friends of California Policy Center's Parent Union. This is a group in LA called Outraged Parents. That's their Instagram account, and they were the only place where I first saw this, and I think they were the folks who dug it up. But somebody did a screen grab here, and I sent you a copy of this.
No, I saw that.
You did,
yeah.
Okay. So it shows at her inauguration, it shows all the folks, you know, who are in attendance, you know, all the LA's best and brightest showing up in what looks like it was at the Staples Center. Well, it's no longer called Staples. It's LA Live. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. The Staples Center
is
crypto.com.
Crypto. The crypt.
What could go wrong? They're competing head-to-head with the FTX arena in Miami.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Is that? Oh,
and that's like a 25-year deal, which 25 to life, if you know what I'm saying. I just made that up right now.
That's really good.
So anyway, I don't understand why they went with crypto.com arena. Like,
it's
the
terrible.
The Bernie Madoff arena was it had such a ring.
Somebody
to it.
Took it.
It would,
I guess. So anyway, there's a kind of side by side screen grab of the video feed from this, and I don't know how they got the video feed because it is raw video that they've got here.
Oh, and it was with a camera.
Well, was it really a camera? Wow.
I declare a state of camera.
It shows all these folks unmasked, just hanging out, talking to each other, whispering, doing selfies, that kind of thing. And then as soon as the cameras start rolling, everybody has a mask on, David.
Mm-hmm.
And the New York Times, it says that, you know, the coronavirus, in its report on the inauguration, says the coronavirus itself also remains a scourge. Officials at the event required attendees to wear masks amid an alarming rise in case numbers in the city. But apparently they only required them to wear a mask when the cameras were on.
Yeah, but when I got your email, I was thinking, this bugs me less than it does you. And that's not because it doesn't bug me. It's because I'm just so numb. That's been going on for so long.
Yes.
I mean, this was a thing. Like, I'm so critical of the people that are the COVID morons still saying the things they were saying 2.5 years ago. We were going after Fauci for this in the summer of 2020.
That's right.
When they caught him at the baseball game and he had his mask off and then the camera came on and he put it back on,
right,
and all that.
Right.
So the mask theater, I mean, I'm not trying to take away from your story here, but it's 2.5 years old.
Yeah. Well, it is old, and yet it continues, and we're all supposed to believe, as the New York Times said, that because of the coronavirus, attendees were forced to mask up. No, they weren't.
You know what? I guess I'm going to say something. I do disagree with you.
Okay, please.
There's three options here. No mask with or without camera. That's mm-hmm. the one you and I do.
Right.
Then there's the one they did, which is no mask off camera, mask on camera.
You like the third option.
No, then the third is mask all the time.
Yeah.
And I would argue that the right thing, if you have to pick between the second and third, I'd take the second.
Mm-hmm.
The less masking, the better. But what are they doing with a mask on at all, on or off camera?
Right.
Just for the love of God, I can't take it anymore. It is so stupid. And you just want to grab these people. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have Kevin DeLeon be in charge of mask implementation. He's just going to walk around just smashing people, throwing them on the ground.
Hey, can you check your watch? Because you've got to run.
I have 8 minutes.
Okay, well, I want to make this super fast then. I'm going to skip our story on... I'm just going to read the headline and tell you about it in 45 seconds. Here's the headline from the Wall Street Journal. California long ruled U.S. shipping. Importers are now drifting east. Maybe I'll just pop this in the show notes. It underscores what you and I have been saying now for years, which is that California has so mismanaged the nation's largest ports on the West Coast, has ceded so much authority to government unions and bureaucrats, that we are, and through AB5, destroying the trucking industry. We have allowed the nation's really critical port infrastructure to be commandeered by government establishment types like the ILWU, the International Longshoremen Warehouse Workers Union. And so this story by, let me see who it is, Paul Berger, Wall Street Journal, I'll pop it in the show notes, just says, look, companies are no longer shipping through California. They name Newell Brands, that's the company that does Sharpies. Abercrombie and Fitch is moving its merchandise now through New York and New Jersey to avoid West Coast bottlenecks. Air conditioning giant Trane Technologies is now sending most of its cargo through the ports in the South instead of L.A. So California, once again, this is the exodus, brothers and sisters. These are companies who are no longer feeling like they can trust California to move their products. And so the ILWU and the government bureaucrats who have allowed these suckers in to mismanage our ports, AB5, which has destroyed trucking in Southern California and California in general, these are the people who are destroying our infrastructure and the impact on companies. Companies are voting. They're moving. They're leaving. We have been talking about this for years. Enough said. All right. Maybe the last story is the most important, but we will have more time to discuss this because the final results aren't in. Here's New York Times again. California panel sizes up reparations for black citizens. We have now come up with a formula, David, for determining how much black citizens are owed. And the, let me see if I can find this. The disparity is rooted in unjust housing. I'm blanking on where this is. All they did was they took the... Oh, here we go. The figure was...
Disparities in unjust housing?
Yes. The figure was determined. The amount of money that will go to people who can prove they are descendants of free or enslaved African Americans living in the U.S. before the end of the 19th century. That's your definition. You have to be able to prove that you're the descendant of an African American who is either free or slave but lived in the 19th century in the U.S., not in California, in the U.S., and that we will pay you, the California taxpayers, will pay you $223,200 in reparations of some form to be determined. Cash payment is on the table, just a straight check for about $250,000.
You know what I'm thinking?
What are you thinking? That you're black.
Crypto.
Crypto! Pay them in crypto!
Yeah.
I like your thinking.
But January prices. You know what I'm saying?
I do. It's going to look great. okay, so you take that amount... you get that.
What's
amount.
The ballpark? What are we talking about here? 223 times?
223,000 per person, and they are estimating...
Is that taxable or tax-free?
This is another question. Whether it will be taxed on your federal income, the state would have to pass a law that says it's not taxable in the state, but the federal government is separate, of course, and the IRS may determine this is income, right?
When someone gets money from someone else?
We usually call that taxable, a tax event. The figure was determined by measuring the housing wealth gap for California's black and white citizens between 1933 and 1977. And it's this is according to Business Insider, which doesn't seem to have much inside.
But do they have a number that they
Total amount is $500 billion.
Oh, so they think that once you figure out how many people it is, times the 223, it's going to get to $500 billion.
They did it in reverse. They took the total disparity in housing values of black and white citizens.
But they don't really think that they're going to pass that, do they?
They are already starting to acknowledge that it's going to be a heavy lift to get it passed, because there is a lot of opposition, and not just, huge surprise, not just from white supremacists. It's
I got
ordinary
an idea,
people.
Though. What if you say, we don't believe this is right, we don't believe this is good governance, we don't believe this is a good idea, but because we're going to do it anyways, we're going to pay for it from the annual surplus in our budget.
I love this. This is a great idea. Mm. Yeah.
And then every year you don't have a surplus, it's a war on black people.
That's right. I think this is an awesome thing for the Democrats to consider. You heard it here first. Thanks, David.
You're welcome.
The evidence of their claim is that California in 1852 had a Fugitive Slave Act. The Fugitive Slave Act is a federal law, of course, but some California courts enforced it and sent free blacks or formerly enslaved blacks back. One could find countless examples of situations where black people were not sent back and were in fact freed by local courts and sheriffs. We've talked about some of those. My favorite example is Mason Biddy, who was brought here by a Texan out in what's now San Bernardino County and was freed by the L.A. County Sheriff and subsequently by an L.A. County judge who went on to become a millionaire landowner in the 1880s and 90s and one of the largest philanthropists in California. I could give you other examples like this, but they cherry pick the arguments. They find three good examples of places where eminent domain figured prominently. So an eminent domain is the government's right to declare property, to condemn property for a public purpose, like building a highway or a river or whatever. But the problem here is that Californians continue to invest in progressive policies which punish the poor, including black people, but not only. And if you want an example of that, please see above in this very conversation my allegation that the most systemically racist institution in America is probably the California public education system, which has condemned poor kids and black kids specifically to lifelong learning loss. And this hasn't gone on just in COVID, as they try to claim. This has been going on for decades. We call it the school to prison pipeline. Kids now in California who are black have, on average, about 30% of them can read at grade level. About 10% of them can perform math at grade level at any year you take that test. They are way behind, and then they bomb out of universities because they're so underprepared. And then the allegation is that, of course, the schools are racist. We read this all the time, that universities are racist because black kids don't succeed there. But, of course, black kids come from a racist system run by the CTA and the California Federation of Teachers. So I could go on, David, and maybe we can, you know, revisit this, because the decision's not final. There's still, you know, the commission has to recommend or make its proposal, and the proposal has to be turned into legislation and then has to be passed. But this is going on all over California and some local areas as well. Maybe we'll just have a whole podcast on this one at some future date here. But there is so much garbage in this thing. I just do not. It is absurdity on stilts. I don't see how it succeeds. Never mind the moral problem of just beginning with the idea that you punish people who were not alive then and reward people who weren't alive then when all this
and don't
stuff
do
happened.
That and don't do that for other groups.
You don't do that. Yeah. Asian Americans, who are arguably as mistreated in California and the U.S. in general as black people were.
I don't have a great way to measure it because it's immeasurable. But my point is that, like, you, let's say you came up with a point system. Like, so you say, well, someone was aggrieved by 8 and others by 6, and so do we do a pro rata?
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some racism by omission.
Well, and there's now some anxiety on the left that even white people who are literally of mixed race descent and can trace their ethnic origins back to somebody.
What about a wealthy black person?
Same thing.
No, what are they?
There is zero wealth check on this.
You had legitimately family members that can be traced that were in the 19th century in America,
that's right.
And then based on the formula and so forth. And you right now are, let's say you're a hip hop mogul in LA, and you're worth $100 million.
Right, you get $223,000 by this estimate.
That should make for some good footage.
David, we could go on, but I think that's all the time we have today because you got places to go and I got stuff to write. Let's wind it up. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and so much better for us if you subscribe. That's a hard thing to say. And, of course, rate and review the show wherever you subscribe. And keep the emails coming. We really do. Your notes to us are meaningful, even if David jokes that he doesn't read them. He does.
No, I don't.
On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, Glenn Hall, our researchers Houston Reese, Sheridan Swanson, and Alex Kachatrian. To all of our friends at National Review, thank you guys, and especially you, Sarah Schutte, National Review podcast producer. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa la semana próxima.